This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Steve from the History of the Papacy podcast, and in this interview we're doing today as a part of Agora Presents, we're interviewing an independent author, an independent published author named Bobby Adair, and he's the writer of almost 20 books, and we're so happy to have you on today.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, maybe you can just tell us a little bit about yourself and, you know, where you're coming from.
Oh, gosh, hard questions already.
Yeah, well,
I guess I've done a variety of things through life, but the last probably 15 years I spent writing software for some big and small companies, and always wanted to be a writer, so... I guess through the 80s and 90s, you know, back in the early days, I used to write letters to publishers and say, please, please publish my book. And, you know, they'd always send back a nice letter that was basically no. So I guess at some point about 3 years ago, I kind of became aware of self-publishing and thought I'd give it a go. And gosh, the first two books I self-published did very poorly. The first one, I think I sold 12 copies. The second one, so after that, I thought, wait, there must be something more to just putting your book out there in the world and, you know, having people just throw money at you. And I guess I came to the realization that it wasn't just an artistic endeavor, but a business endeavor that was required. I kind of running in parallel to make a success of it. So the second book sold probably about 10,000 copies. I got very involved in the marketing. And then the third book that I published was the first of a zombie series that now has 9 books. And that one sold, let's just say, a whole lot of copies. Well, actually, let me take that back. I'd set that one up for free initially. So it was a free book. And the idea being that I could kind of let people try it out before buying the subsequent books in the series. And it's worked out really well for me.
Well, that's how I learned about the books. It just came up on Amazon as a free book. So why not, you know?
Yeah.
And now I've read just about every single one of them. And I guess that's one of the things that... Now, did you do this while you were working a full-time job as well, at least initially?
Yes. Yeah. I think the when I gave away the first free zombie book, that was, I think, July of whatever, that 2013 probably? Yeah, so probably July of 2013. I was working full-time then, and I continued to work full-time for just over a year after that. And in that time, I wrote, I think, 4 or 5 more books. So it was basically like having 2 full-time jobs. So
yeah, I mean, wow.
Yeah, it was a lot of work, but the path was worth it. Well, you know, it's like everything in life. I think anything you really want to succeed at, it basically you've got to, well, work very hard at it or get really lucky. And, you know, people, the getting lucky business plan didn't seem appealing to me.
Did you try to sell these ones to the major publishers, the zombie books? I use the word zombie in air quotes because it really isn't the classic zombie story, but we'll get into that in a moment or two.
Yeah, no, I didn't. It didn't even cross my mind. You know, I guess by the time I'd gotten there to release that first zombie book, I probably read, oh, maybe a dozen or two dozen books on self-publishing. So I was really kind of studying the market to see if I could really make a go of it. And I guess by the time I'd gotten to that point, I felt like I understood it well enough that I could make a go of it. And I thought, well, you know, rather than screwing around trying to get a publisher as I had done for years prior to that, you know, why not just try and see how it works out? So,
well, that's one of the things that as a group of podcasters with Agora that we had talked about is that we're kind of a support network for each other in podcasting and trying to get to market, to maybe monetize to some degree. Was there any models out there? You said there was books. Was there a community of self-published writers that you were able to rely on or maybe ask questions of that helped you through that process?
Well, that's a yes and no answer, because there was a community of self-published authors, but I wasn't aware of how to contact any of those people at that point. So, you know, aside from the books I read, I spent a lot of time looking at, well, frankly, just looking at the Amazon web pages and saying, okay, what are successful books doing? You know, what was the thing that makes them, or what are the things that make them, I guess, sell as opposed to, not sell, like my first book obviously didn't, but having said that, that was basically just saying, when you upload a book to Amazon and then do nothing, which obviously did not work. The second time around, I started searching around for various websites where I could promote my book. And again, kind of taking a very reinventing the wheel approach with it, because again, I wasn't aware of any of these other resources yet. So the third time around, again, I had all that knowledge. And one of the things, well, I guess one of the things that I learned just from looking at Amazon is I guess I noticed that people were doing this first one free for a series, and especially in the zombie genre, they give away a first book, obviously, and had people pay for the subsequent books. And then I found plenty of websites where I could actually advertise to give my first book away for free. And I thought, okay, well, that seems like a model that works. So I was really, I guess, for the most part, just copying what other people were doing in terms of marketing. And it was like, you know, what are these people doing that's successful, and can I kind of extrapolate the steps that they're taking? So for those ones that were giving away the first book free, I thought, okay, I can see from here what they're doing, and I think I can do that too. And so I did, and it worked.
What I was thinking is, and this comes in a question from one of our fellow podcasters, Tom, and as we were talking about this, what gave you or helped you build up the nerve to say, you know what, I'm going to ditch my 9-to-5 and do this full tilt? Because that's a huge jump that very few independent podcasters, self-publishers are willing to do or able to do. Was that something you felt inside of yourself that you could really make a go of this?
Well, yeah, I think so. Basically, the first zombie book came out in July of, I'm thinking, 2013. And then in 2014, I actually earned more in royalties than I did from my paycheck at work. Yeah, exactly. So I was like, oh, maybe, because I'd never, as much as I I wanted it to happen and kind of dreamed about it happening, I never truly believed that I would. I always believed that it would be part-time income. You know, it's like, let me kind of get my, you know, I guess for that year I was working full-time, especially I thought full-time writing while working full-time at my job. I thought, you know, let me just work really hard, get myself established, and then I can kind of come back to a manageable work pace and hopefully get a good kind of part-time income doing what I love, you know, to kind of supplement my full-time job. But when I guess had that month where I actually made more money, it really opened my eyes and I thought, wow, is it really possible that I can do this? And then after that, I think I've never had a month where I made less money than I did working full time. So, well, I say that, but you know, there were several months where my gross royalties were always more, but sometimes after I subtracted my expenses, I made less. But now it's to the point now where even after subtracting expenses, I'm doing better now than I did before writing software.
So it really did start out as something as just a little maybe extra pocket change for doing something. Making the money was a benefit of doing something that you were enjoying to do anyways.
Absolutely true. Yes, absolutely.
You said that you started in 2013, or so you're really only 2.5, 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Was this something that was a possibility 5 years ago or 10 years ago, do you
think?
Yeah,
I don't think so. I know that I'd looked into, the concept of self-publishing had been kind of floating around out there for a while. And at first it was all very, you know, certainly in the 90s, for instance, I'm kind of dating myself. Hello, Woody, I'm old. But, you know, in the 90s, you know, in the 80s, you know, it was basically vanity publishing. You know, if you self-publish, I'm going to do this on my own and I'm going to, you know, buy 1,000 books and then give some to my relatives and then put them in my garage for the rest of my life. Although there are exceptions. I believe that John Grisham, a name probably everybody who reads has heard of, I think he started that way. He got a bunch of his books printed and literally just went to bookstores and said, hey, will you sell my book here? And I think that was how he got his beginning in publishing. But that's, I think, the rare exception. And then, you know, after, well, you know, obviously with the, I don't know what you want to call it, the internet revolution, the dot-com revolution, as things really started to change, the publishing is one of those things that changed. And so in the early 2000s, you know, there were websites. I think there's one that comes to mind called lulu.com, where it's like you can actually print on demand. You know, so I could, if I wanted to, I could upload my book and then send people directly to their website to purchase it. You know, so it's like, oh, well, that sounds attractive, but how do I find people to go to that website to buy my book? You know, while that option was available, it didn't seem viable to me in terms of being able to, I don't know, really make any money at it. It kind of seemed just like kind of a half a step in front of vanity publishing. And then I think probably around 2012, maybe, when Amazon's, I think, Kindle came out, and I think self-publishing for an independent really became, I think, real in the sense that you could actually make a living at it. I kind of became vaguely aware of it. I mean, I'd heard things, you know, here and there, and it's like, you know, whatever, you know, blah, 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 blah. But having said that, I was probably still suffering a bit from the stigma that a lot of writers still suffer from, which is that equating vanity publishing with indie publishing. And then of course the we're using the word stigma again, but the kind of talk around the water cooler, I guess, among people who write, it was that, well, if you ever vanity publish, then basically you burned your bridge with ever getting a real publisher because they'll just laugh at you, you know? So it's, so a lot of my, writing, I guess, acquaintances still believe that if you indie publish, you'll never get what they would call a real publishing deal with a traditional publisher.
At this point in your, do you think that published, like getting a full publisher, is that the goal, or is that not even a goal anymore?
that's a really good question too. You know, and the thing, so for me personally, I'm probably, it's something, if you'd asked me a year ago, I'd have been like, no, I have absolutely no interest in getting a real publisher. I'm doing very well on my own. I like my independence. I'm probably making more money doing it this way than most published writers, with a traditional publisher. And, but I think that just in terms of kind of diversifying my, I guess, my business, I'm in the process of actually taking a hybrid approach. I've got an agent, and you know, we're talking about what kinds of, I guess, books I can write for the traditionally published market. So, and probably the way we kind of envision it is that, you know, I'll continue indie publishing as I am, because again, I'm doing very well at it. I'm very happy with it. I'm making good money at it, and I don't want to jeopardize that. But I'll probably publish through the traditional route, one, maybe two books a year, assuming a publisher buys them, you know. And I think, and really that for me is purely, purely about, well, I guess diversification, because I think there's a degree of safety there, because as an indie publisher, to a degree, I'm at Amazon's mercy. If Amazon, you know, emailed me tomorrow and said, you know something, we decided to change our royalty structure, you know, and now it's half of what it was. Literally, my income would, you know, be reduced by half, and there's nothing I could do about it, except say, ouch, that hurt. You know, but yeah. Having said that, I am published through Barnes & Noble and Apple and Kobo and Google Play. So, you know, a reasonable portion of my income comes from those platforms, but the largest part of my income comes through Amazon.
And that seems similar in the way to podcasting, that you really have to get yourself out into multiple different platforms, like you said, Barnes & Noble and Amazon, but Amazon being the one that's a 10,000-pound gorilla.
Exactly.
That's the one that you have, that's whose tune you have to dance to. One thing that I was wondering is, in this, I mean, I'm not looking for your sales figures or anything, but is this more of an electronic medium?
I sell.
Or do you actually have
paper?
Oh, yeah,
I do. And basically, it's Amazon again. They have Amazon owns a company called CreateSpace, which is a print-on-demand company. And basically, every time I release a book, I say, but my wife actually formats it for print, which is a bit of a pain. And she's got a background in a lot of things, so she can do it. So she formats it for print. I upload it to CreateSpace. And then because CreateSpace is somewhat integrated with Amazon, then the print book actually shows up on the product page ebook. But I probably sell, I would say, 1,000 ebooks for every one print book I sell.
Oh, okay. So that sounds about what I was expecting, yeah, in this sort of thing.
And then I was going to say, I sell audiobooks as well. And they do fairly well. And I make decent money on audio. There are people, I guess, authors that I'm, gosh, and I feel weird about saying friends, because, you know, we're in this kind of new sort of world, where I have people I've talked to have never actually met, you know, met in person, right? You know,
yeah.
And I'm sure you're familiar with it. And so it's so I have friends and acquaintances online, and some of them sell far more books in audio format than they do in the ebook format, which is well, yeah, it's great for them, but it's just various formats do, and on various products, I guess, sell differently, so.
Do you think that being independent gives you more creative license than you would otherwise?
Yes, I think so. But having said that, I've never had to deal with a traditional publisher, so I don't know what kind of constraints they place on me. You know, but having said that, I know that as a you know, when you're, I guess, even when you're writing a book as, you know, like back in the day when I was thinking of a traditional publish, going down the traditional publishing route, right? You're kind of, it's always in the back of your mind. It's like, what, you know, what will a publisher think of this? You know, can I say this? Can I broach this subject? You know, do I have to be fairly conservative? Can I be, well, you know, can I be kind of off the wall zombie? You know, and frankly, I think that had Amazon never come along with their indie publishing model, zombie books never would have taken off, because I don't think that traditional publishers were interested in something that niche. And I think that's probably one of the good things about Amazon in general and this whole indie publishing phenomenon, is that it gives authors of what would have been considered a more niche product, a place to sell it, but it provides a place for all the people interested in that niche, somewhere to buy it, you know, and frankly, if you look at romance, romance has done really, really well in the ebook format. And there are lots of reasons people talk about that. And you know, one of them is that I guess one of the theories for it is that people are, they're somewhat embarrassed to read, for instance, kind of a body romance in a paperback form, because everybody sees what they're reading. But if it's on their Kindle, nobody knows. So they're less embarrassed to buy it and less embarrassed to read it. And so that niche, that subgenre, has done really, really well. Again, kind of like zombies, but romance does much better. So I think that's so creatively speaking, it gives us, all the writers, the authors, I guess, a place to sell these what otherwise would have been niche products or even unsaleable products.
What would you say your genre is?
Probably post-apocalyptic, generally speaking. You know, which it fits under sci-fi, I think. You know, cause like when you go to Barnes & Noble, right? You know, the genres are pretty wide. It's like there's sci-fi fantasy, you know, and there's general fiction or literature and romance, and hell, that might be it. I don't know. You know, but if you go out on Amazon, you know, you can drill down to probably 300, 400, maybe 500 genres or subgenres. You know, you could get down to, you know, sci-fi, space colonization, romance, I think, you know, or even you get pretty specific about the kinds of things you are interested in, you know. And I remember back when, for instance, there's a book, World War Z, probably everybody's heard of the movie, but there was a book written by Max Brooks. And I'm trying to think of when it came out, but I'm probably thinking I read it, you know, 9, 10 years ago, maybe 8 years ago, I'm not sure. And I probably, I probably saw it at Barnes & Noble, and I think I remember seeing it there. I was like, oh, great, that looks like a good book. I've never read a zombie book, and that seems interesting because I kind of dig zombies. They're cool. Let me buy it. And I read it, and then I went back to Barnes looking for another book, and I couldn't find anything, you know. And I was like, well, that kind of sucks. And then later on, I think when I started, I guess, buying books on Amazon, there was another book I came across. So I would periodically do searches for like zombie books, because I was like, you know, again, I like World War Z a lot. I wanted to, you know, something else like it. And I read a wide variety of stuff, right? But eventually I came across a book by an author named J.O. Born, I think called Day by Day Armageddon. So I snapped that one up, you know, and it probably wasn't until 2 or 3 years after that, or maybe a couple years after that, when I started seeing, well, when the zombie, when that genre started to get kind of filled up with other books. But before that, they were really nearly impossible to find.
And I think that you don't want to put yourself just in the niche, because I think a lot of science fiction you can read nowadays isn't that great. But yours is really, it's story driven and it's character driven. Moving into talking about your book specifically,
but yeah, I think that there are nine slow burn books. Yes.
And then 3 Ebola K books. Yes. And we'll get into what each of these series is about. And then another book that you co-author with another writer?
Yeah, The Last Survivors, and that series has 5 books, and we're working on the 6th one, the 6th and final one right now.
That's an area that I was wondering a lot, because that has got to be very challenging to co-author a book series like that. What is the process with that?
Yeah.
And how did that idea come about?
Piper Brook, my co-author, he actually emailed me initially, and we were acquainted, I guess. We'd been associated in, I think, at a box that someone else had put together, and so we kind of knew who each other were. So he emailed me and said, "Hey, I want to do this deal, blah 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 blah," and I say the blah 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 part because the truth is that I guess I was in a hurry and I totally misread his email. So he wanted to do something, but nothing. So he emailed him back and said, "Well, you know, I find that idea intriguing. So let's just write this series and do some stuff and blah, 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 blah." And then he was kind of surprised because the project I was proposing back then was much larger than I think he wanted to do, like a little anthology or something with some other authors. And actually looking back at that original email, that's basically what he was asking for. So one thing leads to another. We call each other on the phone. We start talking about ideas, and we both get really excited about it. We're like, "Well, hey, let's maybe we just go ahead and write a series." And the funny thing was that we were both working on other projects at the time. We decided, we both have a break maybe coming up, and I think this was all happening in probably July, August time frame, but whatever year it was. And then we were going to get into it in October. So then the next time we had a call, maybe 2 weeks, a week later, we both actually started writing it because we were excited about it. The process we finally settled on was that we had this world we built that has and it has a lot of characters in it. Probably, it varies because people die. the way we handled it was he would write some of the timelines for some of the characters, and I would write them for some of the other characters. Although we'd switch out from time to time. And then we each edit each other's work. So we wound up with kind of a hybrid of our styles rather than just like my style and his style. And then we knit the stories together. And we knew where each book was going and where the story was going in general. So that wasn't, you know, completely off the wall to kind of put all the stories together, because all the characters were kind of dealing with these central problems. And there were some difficulties along the way. Things we didn't talk about. For instance, I believe in the first book, we never talked about the time frame, like how many days does a story take place over, for instance. You know, and I think I wrote my stuff to take place over 3 or 4 months, and he wrote his to take place over 3 or 4 days.
Oh yeah, that's
right. But it's like we never thought to talk about that. It's like, oh well, okay, well now we've got to make the corrections to make all that work. So there were some difficulties, but I think the difficulties were eclipsed by the benefits, in that it was really fun to sit down and on the phone and through email, talk to another author about ideas and bounce them back and forth and kind of come up with a lot of interesting things. And then kind of out of the whole process, I believe, we talk all the time. I feel like I've got a coworker, and a friend. He finally came down to Texas and visited, last fall, so we finally met, after 4 books.
Wow.
One of those, kind of relationship that's possible today that wasn't possible.
Yeah, it's only possible.
Yeah, 10, 20 years ago. So
now let's get into the actual books, because they're such great books, and I'm so thankful I stumbled upon them, liking the post-apocalyptic genre in general. But I think that that's more of a setting, and it's what you're really, you've developed interesting characters and characters who are, they don't change completely after this world-changing event. They're still, in a lot of ways, they're still carrying a lot of the baggage that they had before.
Yeah.
Maybe you can, the Slow Burn series is that's the largest one in terms of books. Can you just give us a quick synopsis of it?
Oh, wow. Yeah, so the, that's through 9 books. But basically, there's
an overview. Yeah.
You know, as with most, I guess, zombie-type virus-related or stories or post-apocalyptic stories, there's this virus. People fall ill, but it's not, they don't fall ill and then die and turn into zombies. It's more of a virus that kind of, it's a little more like rabies in the sense that, it alters your behavior. So I've got this whole, most people are infected. I've got some people who aren't. And then this very small class of people who got infected, but aren't really, turning into, they're not mentally debilitated, or mentally changed like these zombies are. And the main character in the book is one of these people. So that kind of makes him unique, along with what turns out to be his main buddy. Anyway, so things, you know, the virus comes, the world kind of falls apart, and they've got to try to figure out how to, survive. And then there's this constant talk or this constant problem that they're trying to resolve of how do we get to safety? Where's the safe place? You know, do we hold up here in Austin? The story takes place in Austin, Texas. You know, do we hold up here? Do we and they wind up in a few places. You know, they start out in a dorm on the college campus and realize, oh, well, this sucks because, you know, it was a bad idea. And it kind of goes from one thing to another. And through the whole thing, Zed, the main character, I would say he grows and matures a bit, but he's a character who comes from a really, basically he's a character who's abused as a child, has a very distant mother, has a lot of difficulties dealing with life, but seem to do pretty well in this apocalypse, although his problems come back to haunt him all the time. And then, you know, the counter to Zed is Murphy, who's this guy who's basically got kind of a very happy-go-lucky view of life, and kind of keeps the story and keeps Zed I think somewhat balanced.
Yeah, that's what I thought was so cool about the series. It's over the course of 9 books, and time-wise, how much time it elapsed? About a not that long of a time period.
Yeah, I think probably I'm thinking about six months, because it starts out in August, and I think we end up actually in that the following winter, so probably in January, February. So yeah, so about
inside of that time frame. The main character, Zed, really, he really doesn't, or that baggage that he had beforehand, he's still dealing with it up until the end. And it's, I think that's an interesting way to look at it, that is something like a major world-changing event. It really doesn't change, or it has a difficult time changing who you fundamentally are.
Oh, yeah, and that's true. I think, yeah, fundamentally you are. And that's definitely true for Zed, because... And I think, yeah, there are ways that I think he adapts, I think, to the world. And I think, there are differences, but there are things that you just can't shed from your past in 6 months. Right. I think there's that kind of, when you go to see the movies and sometimes, you know, you have the character who's like, they had this epiphany, right? It's like, oh, I had this epiphany and now I'm a new person. You know, now I'm not going to be a bank robber anymore. Now I'm going to be a veterinarian. You know, so that kind of crap happens in movies. And sometimes it works, you know. Sometimes those stories where, let me digress a bit, but I think on some stories where you have this character go through this kind of transition and become a better person through the course of the story, they're very interesting. But I think for someone like this, like Zed, for instance, who's got so much, so much baggage, it's not possible to get past it all in 6 months. He, you know, frankly, he'd have to go to therapy for 6 months or 6 years and, you know, get on probably an antidepressant. it's going to take him a long time to get through it. But having said that, to a degree, it, I think the two characters, Zed and Murphy, they have conversations about this early on about how, especially Zed kind of having an emotional detachment from other people, it makes it easier for him to do the things that are necessary in this world. Because basically, you know, the zombies, they mostly look like regular people. They don't look like monsters crawling out of the ground, you know, so it's a little more difficult to actually have to shoot someone who looks like a real live person, you know, and was a real person 2 months ago, you know, so that becomes a real problem, well, I guess, for a lot of characters in the book, but less so for Zed and Murphy.
That was a part of the books that intrigued me, is that there is a kind of a realism in there, that the setting is really detailed in Texas, and then that I don't know what you would call it, the health aspect of the zombies, that they've contracted some sort of virus that's impaired their mental faculties, but they're not dead, you don't make that huge of a logical leap. What made you build what made you create the zombie in that way, in a more realistic way, and then the detail of the setting? Why did you choose those two details
I think, well, as far as the zombies, I wanted the story to be plausible, as plausible as I could make it. I didn't like, well, when I'm playing video games, for instance, I like slow shuffling zombies with their eyeballs falling out because I can shoot them, you know, but in terms of a story, and that's the thing I never quite got about zombie movies when I watch them. It's like I'm thinking, well, run, you know, problem solved, you know, so, but having said that, I did want a story that seemed more real and would have a plausible explanation, because, and that's the other thing, that whole crawling out of the ground, shuffling around zombie thing, it just seemed too fake to me. So it didn't really appeal to me, but, a person with a real disease, or as real as I could make it, that was appealing to me. And I liked them to be fast, and I liked them to be varied. I think like life, right? In real life, nothing is black and white, you know, and not everything is exactly the same. And I didn't want my zombies to be that way either. There's a wide variety of people, and there's a wide variety of them, mostly because they're all affected by the disease in a different way. It very, very much like, well, you know, you could, if you're at home, you know, with a wife and you come home with a cold, and you might spend 3 days on the couch watching Oprah, and she might catch it and sniffle a couple of times and go, I'm done. Why are you a sissy? You know? And it's just, that, it's just, that, you know, diseases, viruses and bacteria affect people different ways. So again, kind of going back to what I thought would be a more realistic approach to the disease that I imagine, then I would have, again, people affected differently. And that gave rise to, you know, my main character, Zed. So you wind up having this whole spectrum of zombie behavior or zombie-like behaviors, rather than just this, you know, black and white, you know, Walking Dead people and good guys. And then as far as the details, you know, that's a good question. And I think it just came down to wanting to draw, I wanted people to be able to I wanted it very easy for people to imagine themselves in the story. You know, I want people to, I wanted people to be able to relate to the characters in such a way that, you know, you think, wow, I know this person, I know this character as if he's a real person. I want them to feel emotions for the characters when, you know, when they go through their problems. And even, you know, if some of them die, and if some of them do, but I wanted people to be able to visualize, you know, what those settings were, such that, you know, they can imagine themselves standing there by Zed and Murphy, you know, shooting these zombies and trying to figure out how they're going to get out of the situation. You know, and there's one, for instance, there's one, I think it comes up in book three, where Zed actually gets this wild idea that he's going to drive this Humvee to the top of this parking garage and just shoot all the zombies when they come up. And of course, like most of his plans, it kind of goes to crap. But then he's stuck on this parking garage with no way to get down. And what he winds up doing is kind of going over the, you know, it's like a 4 or 5 story garage, but he goes over the edge, but he slides down this banner. And the interesting thing about that was that I didn't, you know, invent or imagine the banner. There's a hospital in Austin, well, Brackenridge Hospital, where that is. But they actually had this long banner, you know, hanging from the top of the garage all the way down to like the lowest level. And it had been there for like years. And I thought, wow, that would be that's a way to escape, you know. So it's so a lot of the details, and especially a lot of the physical details about the city, are the real places. So it's just it was just all about trying to create a user experience, in Voyage my software days now. But you know, I wanted that reader experience to be as engaging as possible.
And you have other series. You have the one other question I had about writing series in general. You create this detailed universe. Now, is that something that you feel like you want to keep going back to, or do you get to the point where you get sick of it and you want to move on to fresh material?
Both. Both. I think with Slow Burn, I'd originally thought it would go 6 books, and then I guess when I wrapped up the 6th book, and it was a fairly traumatic ending because some favorite characters passed away. But at that point, I thought, well, you know, I've kind of told the story I wanted to tell, so I'm basically done. But you know, as time went by, I thought, well, you know, I think I've got some more ideas and I'd like to explore those. So let me try some more books, you know? So, that wound up being books 7, 8, and 9. And so at this point, you know, in Zed's life, now have you read all 9 books?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay then. Yeah. So, you know that he comes to book 9 and it's like, so for the first time in 9 whole books, he comes to the end of the book and it's like, oh wow, I'm in a safe place and I'm happy. And being happy is a big deal for him, right? Because he's been such a troubled young man all along. You know, so it's almost like at this point it was really weird to leave him there. I'm emotionally attached to these characters, just like, you know, a lot of the readers are, you know? So when I get to that point, it was like, wow, I feel like there's this burden that I've been carrying for a while. It's like having a friend who's always in trouble, you know, or addicted to drugs, and finally they go, I'm clean. And it's like, oh, now I don't have to worry about that anymore. You know? So it's like, I don't have to worry about the trouble that I left, you know, Zed and Murphy in, you know? So, At the moment, I'm very happy with where I've left it. You know, will I write some more in the series? Possibly. Well, I say that, but there's a kind of a little novella thing that I'll be doing later this fall. That's kind of, anyway. It's complicated, but anyway, it'll have those characters in it. So, but as far as being sick of the world, you know, if I get kind of tired of it, then I just don't write in it. And then when I want to, then I will, because I don't want to just put words on a page, you know, just for a paycheck. You know, I want to be passionately involved with what I'm writing, because A, it's fun for me, And that I think that passion turns into a good story that the readers will feel passionate about. So I guess as far as being sick of it, not really, just, but yeah, I guess maybe a little tired from time to time, or maybe out of ideas. Yes. And as you know, as far as that extends to the, like, say, for instance, the Ebola K books, that was always planned as just a three book story. And with the Last Survivors, you know, that was kind of planned as a limited story as well. And we didn't know how long it was going to take us to tell the story we had in mind, but it turns out it's six books. Now, with going back to Slow Burn for a second, could I pick it up and tell more stories in that world? Absolutely. And I might. But there's also a brand new series that I'm starting called Black Rust. The first book came out a month ago. Another book is going to come out, well, probably later today.
Right.
But the way that one's written is it's not so much a serialized story like Slow Burn is, but it's well, ideally, it's kind of standalone, a series of standalone stories. So I could write as many or as few as I wanted to, and that's the idea there. So maybe 3 years from now, when you say, Bobby, are you sick of a world? I might be sick of that world.
It's interesting how you've taken a different tack on the post-apocalyptic, and especially the zombies. They're sort of that. They're as much a part of a setting or a character in and of themselves. In The Last Survivors, they were. Maybe you can get into that story a little bit, because that's a really interesting science fiction story.
Yeah, and I think one of the, I mean, kind of as a quick aside, we Piper Rook and I talked about that a lot. And as far as it's more of a sci-fi, I think, book in kind of a fantasy setting. You know, so you know, given the kind of the epic scope of it, it's more of kind of a fantasy book idea. And from a marketing perspective, those are the readers that are responding to it the best in terms of, efficient marketing dollars, I guess. But having said that, the post-apocalyptic people they download a whole lot of copies, so I'm happy with that. But the idea for the infected people actually came out of I think I probably saw a documentary on PBS some years ago, and it talked about this fungus called cordyceps that would actually it would grow on, like, for instance, an ant, like ants' heads. And then it would, so as the little fungal tendrils kind of burrowed into the ant's skull, it would change the ant's behavior, you know. And when, as I read about it, or as I saw the documentary, I thought, wow, they're like little zombie ants, you know? And then I thought, so when the idea for The Last Survivors came around, part of the concept was, well, what's the plausible explanation, you know, for the zombie-like people in this book? And it came down to a variation of cordyceps, you know, that had maybe mutated so that instead of infecting insects, it now infects, you know, humans. But that was really just kind of the zombie, I think we actually call them, well, the characters in the book call them demons, but the concept for the book had a lot more to do with imagining a society 300 years after the collapse. You know, how do things become different? You know, how does a society kind of regrow in the ruins of the old society? What are the things that are different, or what are the things that, so I guess, I don't know, I'm explaining this badly, but, what does that evolution look like? And in the book, the idea was that, there's a city called Brighton, but it's grown up over, 300 years from an original 57 survivors. And even that came down to, I did a lot of research online about it. It's like, well, what's the smallest number of people you could have for a genetically viable human population? And it turned out it was like, 50 or 60 people, So the idea was that there are these 50 or 60 people that actually survived the apocalypse in this group. And they were the ones that kind of grew through, they grew into this city and a couple of like smaller cities. And then the question that we had to ask was like, okay, so if you have this group of people who are, they start out with, whatever technology they've got on hand, some guns and whatever else, and whatever knowledge, how much of that knowledge then gets passed down to their children? And the question became, if you're in a situation where you have to, hunt animals and grow your own corn and gather berries in the forest, how much of your time do you spend teaching your children algebra and Shakespeare and learning how to read and write? So that all necessarily your children are going to be more ignorant in academics than you are. And so through the generations, people have basically lost all of that knowledge. And then once they kind of reach this state, 300 years forward, we have a culture that now believes that, the world is flat again, because they don't have any concept of the science to prove otherwise. And they have a lot of really, really screwed up beliefs. And then, and as a matter of fact, one of the major themes of the story is that, as is true with most societies through history that aren't intellectually enlightened, women get the short end of the stick. So women are a repressed gender, and men kind of rule the roost. And through the story, women kind of they kind of come into their own through the course of the story. Which hopefully works. I think the part about that is how many women read the first two books and go, gosh, what a chauvinist fantasy. I can't take this crap. So anyway, there's a lot of what I think are very profound, or maybe profound is too self-aggrandizing, but there's a lot of fairly deep ideas and concepts that are explored, through the course of the series. It's a much more complex story than, for instance, The Slow Burn. But whereas The Slow Burn is focused more on the complexities of the characters and their interpersonal relationships, The Last Survivors is focused more on kind of the political aspects of a society evolving without the knowledge that it has today, but being aware of a previous society that was much more technologically advanced than they were.
And that was another one.
There, that was a long-winded answer.
And that one, the world is so small, and you really don't say where it is. I think it was that part of it that you wanted to leave the reader guessing where that actual place was or is.
Yeah. When we first started, we thought let's start with a place that a real physical place. And then that exists today, and then kind of overlay our world on that 300 years in the future. And that was another one of those, like that timeline question we talked about earlier. I think Piper Brook and I started out in two different places. so we wound up with this hybrid place. Which was just fine. And it came out just fine, but that's how that worked.
And then you have your other books. You have the Ebola K, which is quite different as far as premise goes.
Yeah. And that's very much set in a, and yeah, the idea with that was that, so I was, gosh, that's, I'm going to get kind of off the subject here a bit. I was working on a book, about an Ebola outbreak. I kind of started it probably a month or so when I was dabbling with it, when the Ebola outbreak in Africa had taken place. And, so which, you know, was kind of fortuitous timing for the book. But where the ideas kind of, at least for one of the main characters, I think there's a character named Austin Cooper, who is this college student who's in Africa doing, basically teaching street kids, at this little town called Kapchora, which all of the detail behind that came from my son, who had gone to Uganda the summer before and was doing exactly what the main character in the story was doing. He was teaching the kids in Uganda. And he came back with all these really, I think, interesting stories. Well, of course, my son's experience was much more positive than Austin's in the book. You know, but it became part of the backdrop for the story that became Ebola K. But that book is written, and so, basically it's like, okay, what happens, what would be a realistic, what would be the realistic outcome if Ebola went airborne in our modern world? And I did a lot of research studying epidemics throughout history. A lot of it with the Spanish flu in like 1918. To see kind of how a modern society would deal with an epidemic, and then especially looking at how you know, what sorts of problems arise, you know. And I remember one story from you know, the 1918 epidemic. There was, you know, there's a coffin shortage. You know, people were it got to the point where people were actually stealing coffins, you know, because you just couldn't buy one anymore. So, you know, when you think about it, it's like, oh, duh, of course that's going to happen. I mean, what's the normal mortality rate in a country like America? What's our manufacturing capacity for coffins? Mm-hmm. You know, but it's a weird problem to think through, you know. And then what happens, you know, so suddenly your mortality rate goes to the roof. What do you do with all the bodies, you know? And what are the processes that a society would put in place to deal with the bodies? And that actually becomes a very difficult situation for, you know, I guess there's the father character in the story named Paul Cooper, when he has to deal with, you know, disposing, maybe that's not even the right word, you know, but taking care of the body of his wife who has died. It's a very difficult situation, you know, and even walking through the neighborhood and seeing, you know, the bodies on the porches and things like that. Cause you know, that again, societies aren't, they're not set up to handle that volume of the dead. And then, you know, there's all the questions of how does the society, I guess, evolve? You know, what even down to, like, I think at some point he goes to the grocery store, and how do you pay at the grocery store when people don't want to touch paper money anymore because they think the Ebola virus might be on it? You know, so all these things, and I think the interesting thing about it, as far as the story goes, is almost every variation of something that occurred in society and how the characters dealt with it was generally an updated version of something that had actually happened during an epidemic in the past. So the research kind of in a lot of ways, kind of created the story.
That's what I think I really enjoy about your books, and leading into the next series that you're working on, The Black Rust, is that it's not so clear-cut. Like in a lot of the stories where it's going into an apocalypse, it's this clear-cut event, and they really show, like, okay, everything was Jim Dandy before, now everything's gone to pot afterwards.
Right.
And it's just funny, last night our water went out, which I don't think it's ever happened in my life where the water went out. And, you know, it's this slow evolution. You know, because we were doing this interview and I'm thinking about it, you know, I go outside and just making sure like it wasn't just localized to our house, and like everybody's water's out and everybody's kind of like, you know, creeped out about it, and that the town, and nobody was saying anything about it. Like no calls went out, nothing was on the internet about it. And then finally, like a couple hours later, they said it was like half the county was out of water for some reason, which they still haven't explained. And like our neighbor went to the grocery store and like all hell was breaking out there, like people buying the, you know, everything that contained water in it. And I thought, like, how quickly that could get so out of control. And that's just one system breaking down. We still had gas. We still had electricity.
Oh, yeah. And I think that's actually a really good point. Because when you see, you know, like when you see like the blackouts, like when they have them, I think there's a big one in New York, you know, I'm trying to think how long it was, 3 or 4 or 5 years ago. You know, and people are like, how do I even get home? And you see these hordes of people just kind of walking over the bridges just to get back to their house, you know, which might be what, 10, 20, you know, miles away. But yeah, it's really, I'm definitely with you there. I guess the thing I like when I write most of all is I want to make things as plausible as possible, as realistic as possible, you know? So no, I don't think there's ever going to be a situation, unless there's a nuclear war, I guess, where it's, you know, hunky dory today, and now tomorrow suddenly we're all living with Mad Max, you know? I think that in a lot of ways, and especially in Ebola K, because they talk about a lot of these same things, and actually even in Black Rust, where society slowly fall apart, you know, with, you know, when one system fails and then something else fails, and it's kind of this piecemeal sort of thing. And actually in the there's a book called Black Virus, which is going to be a prequel to Black Rust, which is the one that's hopefully getting published tonight. But it talks a lot about that, and actually water is a problem. Two of the characters are talking about it. They're like, well, you know, we've got you know, 2-gallon-sized jugs of water on the counter, and we've got some Coke bottles, some empty Coke bottles in the pantry that we filled up with water last time the water was running, because the water gets very sporadic. Sometimes it's running, sometimes it's not. Sometimes electricity's on, sometimes it's not. Sometimes when the electricity's on, sometimes I can get a connection to the internet, sometimes it's not, because, you know, you can get to the, just because your electricity's on doesn't mean the electricity is on at the server farm where your, you know, your connection is. You know, so all these systems start to fail, you know, and it can fail in many ways, and they have all these failure points. And then obviously people start kind of flipping out. Like you said, people start running to the grocery store thinking, holy crap, you know, the world's coming to an end. You know, and of course it's not, which we say, but one day when there is a major catastrophe, those people that panic and run to the store first are the ones that are going to have some water, and the rest of us, the ones of us that stay calm and collected, we're going to be like, oh shit, I don't have any water. Yeah. And the weird thing is like in Texas, I guess, we lived in Denver for a while. We now live back in Texas, but you know, when it snows down there, or they predict there's going to be a freeze, it's crazy. You go to the grocery store and people are stocking up like crazy. And it's like, and I just want to say, calm down. Yes, it's going to freeze, but you have to remember this is Texas. So come tomorrow, it's going to be 80 degrees again. So calm down, you know?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. It's like also in a lot of ways, things that we're very accustomed to right now can become the new normal if they go away. Like you said, if internet access becomes sporadic and electricity, it becomes normal pretty quickly, and people people adjust to new ways, where you'd think that, oh my God, I could never live for a second without constant running water, but you definitely find ways to make do.
Yeah. And I think that making do is what kind of becomes interesting in the story, you know, especially as things get worse and worse and worse. It's interesting stuff.
If wrapping up here, are there any plugs you'd like to do? You said that there's a new book coming out today as the recording of this, so it'll definitely be out when it's released. Is there any other projects that are upcoming that you could probably throw out a little teaser on?
I guess so. There's I mentioned Zed and Murphy earlier from Slow Burn. There's another author named Nicholas Sansbury Smith, and he's another one of my online friends who's also an author. Anyway, he convinced me to do. There's this thing called Kindle Worlds, and basically the way it works is people write books in somebody else's universe. For instance, if I was signed up for it or whatever, somebody could go out there and write a Slow Burn book, for instance. So what Nick and I have talked about is taking Zed and Murphy and then putting them in the Extinction Cycle universe, and seeing how that goes. So I'm working on something with Zed and Murphy, but it won't be in the Slow Burn universe. It'll be in the Extinction Cycle universe, and that'll be out in, I think, October 19th.
Oh, wow.
So this, you have a scoop. You're the first person who knows. I guess besides me and Nick and the Kindle Worlds people, but so that's coming up. Besides that, nothing concrete. I'm probably gonna write two or three more Black Rust books this year. I may do some more with Zed Murphy. Kat, my wife, we've talked about doing another, story with Zed Murphy, Steph, and Dal Hoover, kind of the main characters there. And, but not really. Maybe taking a bit of a skip in time, so maybe jump a year or two ahead from where we kind of left him in Happy Land out in Balmoria, and kind of putting him into another situation that might turn into a trilogy. And so we're kicking the idea around quite a bit. So her and I talk about the plots in the books quite a bit. If I can kind of hammer out what I think would be a really good story for them in that universe, then I'm going to write that. Just for a lot of reasons, right? I like the universe. I'm very attached to the characters. they're almost like family now, you know? That's kind of on the back burner for the moment, or it's simmering on the back burner. Let's put it that way. You know, so once the way these things normally work with me is, I guess, once I kind of,
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah! What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Get that story kind of solidified in my head, then probably I'll just jump in and just blast through a draft and, you know, have something written in 6 weeks. So usually I write pretty fast once I kind of know where I'm going with the story. So it's possible that there might be another book. Well, of course, there's the one in October. There might be something else in that universe with those characters before Christmas. Oh. But we'll see. You know, I'm not going to promise because I always get in trouble. It's like, sometimes it's like, I don't know. It's hard to, I tend to overpromise what I can deliver. So that's what it is when it comes to writing.
And we did speak of it earlier, but these books are available on Amazon and BarnesandNobles.com and iTunes Store, Google Play, anywhere else that you...
And Kobo. Oh,
Kobo.
Kobo. Yeah, and Kobo is really big in Canada and internationally and not so big here in the U.S. So, but yeah, those are the places where I saw
them. You can get these books. Go get them now. We just scratched the surface, minimally scratched the surface on these books. So you should definitely go get them. And I'm going to keep checking my phone for the book that's coming out today. Will it actually come out?
I'll get all the files uploaded today. And the way most of them work is it takes anywhere from 1 hour to 48 hours before they actually publish it. And I don't have any visibility in the process. So I don't know what they do on their end. But so let's say probably tomorrow.
All right. I'll keep checking my phone for updates. Well, cool. Thank you very much for coming on. And we really appreciate it. And I think this was a great interview.
Yeah, I had a good time. Thanks for having me.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.